from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen from Boston, Massachusetts, I can prove it. We're in Boston, Massachusetts, because straight ahead is a phalanx of National Guardsmen looking right back at us. And overhead is the Hood Dairy blimp. Now, that might be a contradiction, you know, the National Guardsmen to protect the perimeter and a civilian dairy blimp overhead. But I'm sure everything is fine. I'm sure everything is fine. Yeah, there's something big going on in town this week. Right now, as a matter of fact. Bill Clinton signing books at the Barnes & Noble in Copley Square. The line was forming yesterday. I can't believe that the National Guardsmen are here just for that, though. The Democratic National Convention, the big let's pretend we have an answer to the war, and let's all shut up about it, and get Bush out, and then convention is opening tomorrow. And, of course, one question weighs more heavily than any other on the delegates and the media that have flocked to this event. Where are the good parties? Swear, ladies and gentlemen, that's all anybody cares about. Where are the good? Am I missing a really good party? You went to what? And I didn't. Suffice to say, the party I went to last night was not what you'd say would be one of the parties that you'd kick yourself for missing. It was the media party. The welcoming the media party. This is a kind of a tradition. It happens in the big convention center in town, whatever town the convention is in. And I first experienced this in New Orleans back in 1988, and they actually had Mardi Gras floats going through the convention hall. And I thought, isn't this great? And then I realized, getting to know New Orleans a little better, they do it for every convention that ever comes into. They do it for the hardware guys. They do it for the national lingerie merchants. It's just, that's what they do. But you're supposed to be impressed, and if it's your first time in town, you are. Well, this is Boston, ladies and gentlemen. So it was in the big convention center, and chefs from all the fine restaurants had little food stations, because nothing gets the media's attention like the magical two words, free food! And to impress us with the new Boston, there was a photo montage on the walls on both sides as you rode down the escalator into the grand hall at the convention center. And it didn't have any words on it. It just had faces. But it obviously was the diversity montage, the many faces of Boston. So there were Africans and Indians and Latinos of various varieties, and of course, an African American young man with headphones on. That's not stereotyping, is it? And in the middle, smack in the middle of the hall, staring out, a pair of eyes, a pair of female eyes. That's all you could see of the face. The rest of it, above and below, totally enveloped by a black chador. Maybe dial down the diversity just a little bit. What do you think? Hello, welcome to the show.
Yeah.
from the other edge of America, from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another, yet another edition of the show. And if you're in any doubt about how intensely eventful the Democratic National Convention this week is going to be, here from the found object file, ladies and gentlemen, a piece of tape supplied by, of course, an unidentifiable source, from Tom Brokaw's interview with John Kerry shortly after the interview was over, when they're just chatting as they're being photographed walking down a corridor in Faneuil Hall. Just because Kerry was apparently earlier in the conversation giving Tom Brokaw some crap about the fact that the networks, the broadcast networks, are only covering 3 hours total of the conventions this week. Is that collusion or just good sense? Anyway, Kerry was remonstrating with Tom about this, and the conversation continued thusly.
I mean, the news division is fighting for this more than
they're fighting it?
Yeah.
Well, I think you should. I think that it's a big deal, and I'd love, for instance, I know some things that are going to happen that are really going to be emotional and important in terms of communicating to people. Give you an example. We've got a 10-year-old girl who's going to talk before Teresa.
Yeah. You got to cover that. You got to cover the 3 10-year-old girls. That's why we get press passes, ladies and gentlemen. That's exactly why we line up for the free food. Ladies and gentlemen, from the priciest banana, this is now going so totally out of whack that I think we might just close the whole thing down. The woman English TV breakfast show presenter who last week half ate a banana and then it was sold for charity for about $100. She repeated the stunt this week. The banana then went for $4,500 to an anonymous bidder at a charity auction. So only bananas that are actually meant for human consumption, ladies and gentlemen. No charity bananas anymore. Okay, so this program will deal with the stuff that's not going on in Boston to a large extent, except for the 3 10-year-old girls. We've got to cover that. But there's so much else going on, or not. For example, if you're a commission or an investigator and you're looking into something and you find that a lot of it went wrong, do you blame the individuals in charge, or do you say it's a systemic failure? Two cases in point. Dateline Washington, military interrogators working in Iraq and Afghanistan improperly embraced the harsh techniques that have been approved only for use on Guantanamo detainees, according to a 321-page report issued Thursday by the Army Inspector General. So the commanders, plural, in Iraq and Afghanistan incorporated the harsher techniques into their interrogation policies based in part on memos they had read about the Guantanamo interrogations. So 3 people already, 2 commanders and a memo writer. But the report said the commanders failed to take into account the different standards applied to Guantanamo and to Iraq and Afghanistan, where the Geneva Conventions largely applied. Nice choice of verbiage there. The report found no evidence of a systemic failure, because the only people to blame are a couple commanders, a memo writer, PFC Lindy England. Then we have the 9/11 report, which says the whole system is bluey, the intelligence collection, communication, decision-making process. But you don't blame anybody there, because those would be important people. That's a systemic failure, you see. Depends on the rank and pay grade of the people who would shoulder the blame, apparently, is whether you blame them or whether you blame the system, ladies and gentlemen. So, clearly, you know me, I haven't read the 9/11 Commission report. I'm not going to fool you. But I've read some stuff from it. For example, the report says, and I know I've been thumping this tub for a while. Quote, "It is hard to overstate the importance of Pakistan, our good friend Pakistan, in the struggle against Islamist extremism. Within Pakistan's borders are 150 Muslims, scores of al-Qaeda terrorists, many Taliban fighters, and perhaps Osama bin Laden. Pakistan possesses nuclear weapons and has come frighteningly close to war with nuclear-armed India." Iraq, Iraq was a threat. We know that. The source, also from the 9/11 Commission, a source claimed bin Laden asked for and received assistance from an Iraqi bomb-making expert. Ooh, that sounds threatening. Who remained there giving training until September 1996, which is when the information was passed to the United States. The information is puzzling, continues the 9/11 Commission, since bin Laden left Sudan in May 1996. In May 1996. And there is no evidence that he ventured back there or anywhere else for a visit. In examining the source material, the reports note that the information was received third-hand, passed from the Foreign Government Service that does not meet directly with the ultimate source of information, but obtains the information from him through two unidentified intermediaries, one of whom merely delivers the information. That's the Iraqi intel. Also from the report, George Tenet told us that in his world, the system was blinking red. By late July, Tenet said it could not get any worse. Not everyone was convinced, continues the report. Some asked whether all these threats might just be deception. On June 30th, the senior intelligence executive brief contained an article titled, quote, Bin Laden threats are real, unquote. Yet Steve Hadley, Condoleezza Rice's number one guy, told Tenet in July that Paul Wolfowitz questioned that reporting. To give a sense of anxiety at the time, one senior official at the Counterterrorism Center said he and a colleague were considering resigning in order to go public with their concerns. Obviously, they decided against it. And my favorite tidbit from the 9/11 Commission report, answering the question posed by the Michael Moore film, what's the deal with that 7 minutes where the president sat in that classroom and read My Pet Goat after he'd been told the United States was under attack? I know the answer is not he wanted to know how My Pet Goat came out. This is Bush in his, not his testimony, ladies and gentlemen. He didn't testify. He had a meeting with the 9/11 Commission, not under oath. Not tape, but somebody took notes. And here's what the president said about why he stayed in the classroom reading My Pet Goat. Quote, the president felt he should project strength and calm until he could better understand what was happening, unquote. Sometimes you explain too much, you know. I think he just explained the last 3 years of his presidency. Other things that you may have missed, ladies and gentlemen. From not being in New Orleans last night, here's what we all missed. The return of the Rock'em Sock'em Tour, featuring hardcore anything goes midget boxing and wrestling, emceed by Puppet the Psycho Dwarf, and starring such illustrious mini-combatants as Pondo, Vomit, and Spider. No rules, barbed wire and thumbtacks are allowed, and the tour's motto is no silence, all violence. Midget boxing and wrestling, for your listening pleasure. It's midsummer, I guess, is the only answer to that question. Something we've been talking about here for a few weeks, the mysterious crowning ceremony of the Reverend Sun Myung-moon in an office in the Dirksen Senate office building, which can only be obtained by a senator. No senator has been willing to stand up and say, yeah, I signed the thing that let them have the crowning ceremony for Reverend Moon. This week, Senator John Warner's office announced that he arranged for religious activists to use the Senate office building for that ceremony. At that ceremony, Reverend Moon declared himself the Messiah and said his teachings have helped Hitler and Stalin be reborn as new persons. Yeah, I noticed. The senator did not attend the coronation-like ceremony or realize it would involve Moon, who spent 18 months in prison in the 1980s for tax fraud. Hey, if you're going to distrust everybody who's, you know, on the line for tax fraud, then you wouldn't believe Ahmed Chalabi. Our office felt misled, said Senator John Warner, a spokesperson, after news accounts described the long ceremony in which Moon and his wife were crowned. In an embarrassing governmental gaffe, an official tribute sign erected on the fence surrounding Ground Zero in New York actually misstated the date of the terror attacks. A visitor recently complained about the error. The sign noted that September 11th, 2002 was a pivotal day for the country and the world. The Pentagon has found President Bush's inadvertently destroyed National Guard records that was microfilm reported a couple weeks ago, inadvertently destroyed. Now the Pentagon says that report was an inadvertent oversight. So there's plenty of inadvertency to go around. And Microsoft is in talks with five or six potential buyers for its online magazine Slate. The company is in early discussions with several media companies over a potential sale. I suggest selling it to NBC so it can be read by as few people as watch MSNBC, Microsoft's other partnership, media partnership. By the way, here in Boston, you realize again why people in the media like political conventions, aside from the free food. Free newspapers. Man, if you grew up like I did, just loving to read newspapers and loving to get all the newspapers you could from anywhere, this is like the biggest treat in the world. Here they all are. Free. Suddenly deprived of any sense that they're of value because you want them so much that they're yours for free. Like information should be free, except, of course, it's usually not. Here, you know, big piles. Take them. Please read our stuff. See how good we are. From every newspaper you've ever heard of. So, you know, despite the fact that nothing's going on here, we want to read about it for free. But there are other stories. Big story this week, the Sandy Berger story. President Clinton's former national security advisor, his Condoleezza Rice, if you will, paid a couple visits to the National Archives to review documents prior to his testimony and to Bill Clinton's testimony. Yes, they testified before the 9/11 Commission. And as you know by now, Berger has been under investigation since October. The report leaked this week of his investigation. He immediately resigned as a foreign policy advisor to Kerry, who said he didn't know about the investigation until he read it in the newspapers, even though Bill Clinton did. What apparently happened, as far as we know, although there are many differing accounts, is that Sandy Berger was reading this stuff in the National Archives, where you're not supposed to take anything away, even your notes, unless they're approved by personnel. And said personnel observed him walking away with some material, some copies of documents, and some notes, without having, without so much as a by your leave. Some reports said he stuffed them in his socks. Some reports said he put them in his pants. His lawyer said he put them in his briefcase, conflated with his own documents because he's a messy guy. One report said that archive personnel, having noticed this once and noticed that Berger had a strategy of trying to distract them to get out from under the monitoring, increased their monitoring activities. And now, starting this March, they have closed-circuit cameras in the archives. The lawyer for Sandy Berger has so far questioned the timing of the leak. You know, when you can't argue the facts, argue the timing. But what sounds like a potential scandal for some may, in fact, just be another great business opportunity.
All through, Mr. Berger?
Yeah, you bet.
No classified documents in your socks today?
No. Those pesky socks.
Well, see you next time.
Thanks again.
Neat pants.
Yeah, they're the new Dockers.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I never knew Dockers could be so stylish and yet so roomy.
Go figure, huh?
For those days when you just have to take your business home, now there's something new. Classified Dockers. With more room than the average briefcase, classified Dockers let you pack it all.
Oh, Mr. Berger, something fell out of your trousers.
Oh, that really was an accident.
The secret is out. For classified docs, classified Dockers. When you're stuffing your pants with more than yourself.
Yeah.
This is Le Show from Boston. And we'll get light and frothy again in a moment, but gotta go outside the bubble, where it is not exactly light and frothy. This week, of course, the 9/11 Commission released its report here in the United States about 9/11, hence the name. But reports were issued in Britain and Australia in the last couple of weeks regarding pre-war intelligence that are so nuttily coincidental with what happened here. It just makes you think. So, or not. It just makes you want to not think. So the story in Britain. By the way, before that, in the welter of reports that blame the intelligence agencies and say it was bad intelligence and bad intelligence was passed and the decision makers couldn't do anything because who knew? It's interesting to remember three names that were discussed on this broadcast in the run-up to the war, so they weren't a big secret, except to most Americans. Greg Thielman from the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, which the New York Times this week cited as having the most reliable intelligence of any of the agencies on the state of what was really going on in Iraq. That's why it was disregarded. Dr. Brian Jones in Britain of the Defense Intelligence Service, and Andrew Wilkie from Australia's Office of National Assessment, all three of whom went public before the war started saying, wait a minute, this isn't what we know, what you're being told. None of them resigned, but all three of them went public and said that, and of course, we didn't notice. All right, so now, in Britain, most of the controversy has been about the claim that Saddam, the claim made by the British government in the run-up to the war, that Saddam was able to mobilize weapons of mass destruction in as little as 45 minutes for an attack, possibly on Britain. That was the most controversial piece of intelligence they were playing with. We've learned in the recent past from reports that came out in Britain that the certainty of that claim was bolstered by a last-minute piece of intelligence that arrived just before the government went public with its so-called dossier. That last-minute piece of intelligence has since been, and I shared this with you a couple weeks ago, withdrawn by the head of British intelligence. It was withdrawn, you know, after the war was over. Who needed it then? And now this week, it became known that that last-minute piece of intelligence was never analyzed by the Defense Intelligence Service, which is the office in Britain that would normally analyze and evaluate such pieces of information. All very suspicious, all leading to these remarks by Dr. Brian Jones, not the late Rolling Stones guitarist, Brian Jones, the head at the time of the Defense Intelligence Service. These are excerpts from an interview he gave this week to the BBC.
All through, Mr.
No, that's not what that is. Clearly. Here's what that is. Right now, here's Dr. Brian Jones.
I doubted at the time that there would be a single new piece of intelligence that could have shifted the picture in the way that was being suggested, could have tightened the whole assessment. Because of the additional detail over and above that which we already had that would be required to really move us up to the point of near certainty about the situation. And it was quite difficult to believe that something that voluminous and that detailed would become available. And what's more, the other problem I had was that I couldn't think who would have been in a position to do an analysis of that sort of information other than my own staff and a few other people in the DIS who were experts on this. We were told at the time that it did clinch it and that we should bury our concerns, if you like. No more was said or heard about that until quite recently when the information was revealed in Lord Butler's report that intelligence had actually been withdrawn, and I found that extremely surprising because the intelligence at the time was said to be so convincing. It would appear that from what is now in the public domain, that intelligence was from an untested source. And that is the sort of very fundamental error in intelligence that, 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 that I find quite staggering. Well, I was always doubtful that it did add that or could have added that degree of certainty. My experience, my antennae were up on that particular issue. I happened to be in a position where I wrote the minute that said that this is a problem. But I think all the experts in the Defence Intelligence Staff had problems with the situation. From our perspective, at least, from all that we had seen, you could not make statements with that degree of certainty. To be honest, we were so unimpressed, if you like, by the 45-minute intelligence that we thought that you guys in the press and that MPs would look at that and scratch their heads and ask a lot of questions about it. I think the thing that surprised us most was that wasn't pursued in great depth at the time. But that just proves that our perceptions of public reactions weren't good. But the real difficulty is that the three weapon systems that are generally put under this heading, WMD, are nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. They are three very different systems. And in fact, one of them, chemical weapons, some people would argue hardly qualify to be put into the same category as nuclear weapons and biological weapons. You know, because their effect in producing mass casualties per unit weight of agent delivered, for example, is very much smaller than the other two. The problem when it comes to Iraq, of course, is that Iraq had only used chemical weapons. Therefore, if you describe chemical weapons as WMD, then that carries with it all the thoughts of nuclear weapons, and I think it was very definitely a misleading term. From our normal definition of a threat that we used in the intelligence community, we would not have described Iraq as presenting a major threat. It's difficult to see exactly what the specific threat relating to Iraq was at that particular time. If you talk in the very broadest sense about a long-term potential threat from WMD and terrorism, as the Prime Minister does, and I think the Prime Minister is quite right to emphasize that. But if you talk about that and then conflate that with Iraq, I think you're causing a great deal of confusion. One particular point that I think needs to be emphasized is that terrorists would not need a rogue state such as Iraq to acquire chemical or biological weapons. They probably would for nuclear weapons, but they certainly don't need a rogue state to acquire chemical or biological weapons. They'll do it themselves. It'll take them time, but we know terrorists can be very patient. So if you like, I don't see that as contributing to an immediate threat that needed a very fast response. The body that approves intelligence assessments, quite frankly, should have been aware, on the basis of all the intelligence available, that it didn't underpin wording of that strength. I am surprised, looking back, that they felt they were able to sign off on that information. Perhaps there was a broader reassurance obtained from this new compartmented intelligence that I didn't see. We now know, if there was, that it was unfounded.
Aside from that, everything's fine. So the terrorists would be buying nukes from what? General A.Q. Khan in Pakistan? Yeah, that's where they'd go. Time for the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Quick. Oh, yeah. Now, first of all, there's been a lot of talk about an increasing tendency for people to be punished or arrested for wearing anti-Bush T-shirts at Bush rallies, and that's what the first apology has to do with. But lest you think that this is in any way a partisan phenomenon, here in Boston this week, the Boston Globe reports, the city of Boston slapped a fine on a pizza maker for flying a banner in support of President George Bush on his shop across the street from the Fleet Center. So it's a bipartisan attack on free speech. After Charleston City Council agreed to apologize Monday to two people arrested at a President Bush appearance in the city this month, Mayor Danny Jones suggested sending the couple some West Virginia T-shirts. Dateline San Luis Obispo, the Reverend Rick Eastman apologized for saying gay marriage is like a terrorist attack on the traditional family. After his Sunday sermon at the Church of the Nazarene, Eastman apologized to about a dozen protesters picketing in front of the church. He had earlier retracted last week's terrorist references, but said he was still opposed to same-sex marriages. In hindsight, I should not have used the word terrorist. I'm sorry, and I apologize to the people it would have hurt. Who, terrorists? John Kerry, member of the 9/11 Commission, had a meeting with a pair of right-wing protesters who were at a press conference where the commission was releasing its report. Kerry entered the building. They shouted after him, asking if he thought Sandy Berger should go to jail. Protester then called out, "You're a public official doing the public business. You could stick around all day today." He was referring to Kerry's premature departure when President Bush, this report says, testified, but we know he met with the commission. Then he stormed down the steps at us, recalled another protester, who arrived dressed like Berger with papers coming out of his sleeves and socks. Kerry demanded their names. One protester said only that he was a member of the public. "So am I, a-hole," said Kerry, using the complete word. Kerry returned later to apologize. Quote, "Sorry I called you an a-hole," he said, using the complete word. A bizarre website portraying the city of Duluth in a less than flattering light will be cleaned up and the domain name possibly sold. That's the word from Nicholas Benson of Duluth, Minnesota, who launched www.duluthtourism.com 2 years ago, is, as in his words, a joke. The site, which contains strong sexual content, profanity, and racist commentary, takes thinly veiled shots at local businesses and politicians. One of those people is the Duluth's mayor, who's seen standing in front of a theater with a marquee that reads, "Gay Porn Night." "I didn't mean harm to anyone. I don't have a beef with anyone," said Benson. "Anyone that I've ever talked about with seemed to think it was funny." He has apologized. A top Asian soccer official refused to back down this week from comments that booing by Chinese fans during opening ceremonies at the Asian Cup called into question Beijing's fitness to host the 2008 Olympics. "Beijing fans, you really need to learn some manners. Otherwise, how can you hold the 2008 Olympics?" Asian Football Confederation General Secretary Peter Velapan said in widely reported comments. That drew a furious response from some Beijing fans. Velapan said he met with fan representatives who asked him to apologize. "If I hurt your feelings," he told reporters in the eastern city of Jinan, "if I hurt your feelings, I will apologize. If I hurt your feelings, I apologize." That's another of those if apologies. A senior Russian politician was stopped and frisked by London police near the residence of Tony Blair, prompting a quick apology from British officials. Mikhail Margalov, the head of the Federation Council's International Affairs Committee, he's considered close to Putin, was walking with the British Foreign Ministry along Whitehall, a stone's throw from number 10 Downing, when policemen stopped him and told him he was to be searched. He'd shown the police his diplomatic passport, to no avail. "They checked my briefcase and my cell phone," he says. "They asked me to spread my legs and arms apart and frisked and searched me." A spokesman for Scotland Yard declined to comment on the incident. British officials were nonetheless quick to issue an apology. Management of Asian Noodles, a popular fast food chain featuring Japanese noodles, apologized for its menus, which refer to Taiwan as an independent country. The chain exists in China. "We're sorry. It is by all means a serious mistake with the copy editing of the menu," said Miao Tianfu, a spokesman for the Japanese-based company. He said all of the company's outlets have stopped using the controversial menus, and the person responsible for the mistake has been fired. "Now you're talking. That's the way you handle mistakes. We are simply a commercial agent for Japanese food. We don't want to see this issue utilized for political purposes," said the spokesman. Mayor John Hickenlooper of Denver publicly apologized to the family of an unarmed man shot in his bed last week by a police officer. I want to publicly, on behalf of the city, apologize on the most profound level, Hickenlooper said after taking the microphone to a mixture of applause and boos. Family members accepted the apology and said they appreciated the mayor's words, but they want more answers. Like why Denver elected a mayor with a funny name. A Republican state lawmaker in Michigan said the GOP would fare poorly in this year's elections if it failed to, quote, suppress the Detroit vote. State Representative John Papageorge of Troy, Michigan, said this week he'd used a bad choice of words, but said his remarks shouldn't be construed as racist. He apologized if I have given offense in any way to my colleagues or in Detroit or anywhere. Anywhere. That's a universal apology, except it has, of course, the if in it. Getty Center officials, that's a museum in Los Angeles, apologized Monday for an incident in which a volunteer tour guide at the art museum rubbed two black students' heads and, in a discussion about textures, described their hair as rough. Parents and teachers said the students, who were on a field trip to the center, thought they were being ridiculed and that the docent was invoking racial stereotypes. Referring to the incident as unfortunate and unintentional, Getty officials pledged to provide more sensitivity training for the staff. The docent was explaining smooth and rough textures in stonework and other materials when she touched the youngster's hair, said fourth grade teacher Taliba Shakir. She started talking about smooth and rough textures, and she grabbed the head of one of my black boy students, don't call him boy, and rubbed his head and said, "This is rough," the teacher said. The kids were in shock. It was like she had just ripped out their spirits. The guy did it again with another child. The Swedish furniture giant IKEA refused to make a delivery to the Israeli Arab town of Kalansua near Netanya, claiming it was dangerous. I know how they feel. The son of the mayor bought furniture in the sprawling store near Netanya when he wanted to pay. He was told IKEA does not make deliveries to his area because it was too dangerous. I felt humiliated and insulted, he said. An IKEA spokesman said the company had apologized and it would not happen again. Film director James Cameron has apologized to the family of a Titanic officer who he portrayed as a coward in his award-winning epic. First Officer William McMaster Murdoch is depicted taking a bribe from a passenger desperate to get into a lifeboat in the movie. Eyewitness reports of the disaster insist Murdoch was a hero during the desperate hours. Cameron has issued a public apology to Murdoch's furious relatives, who contacted him twice to complain about the script before the movie was released. Cameron now says, "I think I have come to the realization that it was probably wrong to portray a specific person. In this case, First Officer Murdoch is the one who fired the weapon. First Officer Murdoch has a family, and they took exception to that, and I think rightly so." All Nippon Airways pilot in Japan ignored company regulations, his co-pilot's protests, and common sense, allowing dozens of passengers to enter the cockpit of his plane in a flight earlier this month, earning a severe reprimand from the Transport Ministry. "We deeply apologize for this incident, especially as it occurred at a time whenever greater security precautions are supposed to be taken," the airline says. The pilot admits to being wrong. "We knew exactly who the passengers were," he said. "I knew about the cockpit regulations, but I couldn't say no to them." Who were they? Doesn't say. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, actors George Eads and Georgia Fox will both be back on the job next week on CSI, Crime Scene Investigation. After learning how TV networks play hardball, they returned to the most popular drama after they were fired for not showing up, because CBS President Leslie Moonves wanted to prove something. Eads then went to the Television Critics Association on Wednesday in Los Angeles and said he'd overslept. He wasn't striking and wasn't trying to apply pressure to the network. "It's a big misunderstanding. Straight up. I want all of this to work out. CSI is part of who I am. I apologize," he said. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. There's now an apologies website. Everybody's getting on this bandwagon. But, you know, it wouldn't be a bandwagon if people didn't get on it. It would just be a pointless vehicle of some sort. There is more news from California, of course. There is the news of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who last week at a rally at a shopping mall denounced the Democrats who are in the majority in the state legislature. He and the Democrats are involved in brutal and bruising negotiations over the state budget, which is supposed to have been passed by now, but of course never is by now. According to now, clearly, even with Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor, people really aren't paying attention to what's going on in Sacramento. That includes me. But from what I read, from what little I read, the cuts that Schwarzenegger wanted in the budget and had originally proclaimed he'd gotten have been sort of whittled away by the Democrats who control the place, which people who knew politics thought might well happen. They'll kowtow to him in public and then, slice him up in private. Anyway, trying to go public with his fight, Schwarzenegger appeared at a shopping mall and called the Democrats girly men. Now, that's a reference to a sketch on Saturday Night Live where two Schwarzenegger impersonators used that phrase. And Republicans were quick to defend him, castigating the Democrats for lacking a sense of humor, the same sense of humor they lacked when Whoopi Goldberg made those remarks at Radio City Music Hall that the Republicans said John Kerry should disavow. In both cases, I think they missed the point. How about not funny? How about, yeah, a sense of humor, but how about funny? Anyway, Democrats were outraged. Republicans were defensive. And I just wondered if Arnold wasn't protesting just a little bit too much.
1, 2, 3. Oh, sorry. 5, 6, 7, 8. I want to be a girly man. Have awesome tits and a great looking can. Ride with some dudes in their tricked out van. I want to be a girly man. Being a guy is such a great job. You can be a dandy, you can be a slob. Believe you me, I've got what it takes, but it just doesn't frost my cakes. I want to be a girly man, wear lots of makeup and say it's a tan. Dyeing my hair, that's part of the plan. I want to be a girly man. You know from movies I'm in love with my bod. It's my meal ticket, it's my muse, it's my god. Don't get me wrong, I love my wife, and I'm not going under the knife. I want to be a girly man. Squeeze some boobs and say I'm part of the clan. Go home and whip up a great tasting flan. I want to be a girly man.
I want to be a girly man.
Girly man. Sometimes I'm blatant, but I'm always latent. I want to be a girly man.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show, and yes, we did attack the wrong country. The 9/11 report concludes that al-Qaeda's relationship with Tehran and its client, the Hezbollah militant group, was longstanding and included cooperation on operations, which they said al-Qaeda did not have with Iraq. Coincidentally, this week, Halliburton announced the Justice Department has begun a criminal investigation of the company in connection with the operations of one of its subsidiaries in, drumroll please, Iran. Halliburton said it received a subpoena from a federal grand jury that's seeking documents from its Iranian dealings. While Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, a Halliburton subsidiary located in the Cayman Islands. Why would you be there? So you can deal with countries that are on the U.S. don't deal with them list. U.S. regulations prohibit American countries from trading with Iran. Cheney lobbied against the sanctions, saying they were ineffective. I guess they were. He should know. Number 10 Downing Street, back to the bubblicious information, has admitted that repeated claims by Tony Blair that 400,000 bodies have been found in Iraqi mass graves is untrue, and only about 5,000 corpses have so far been uncovered. That's still 5,000 too many. And Australian intelligence relied on thin and ambiguous information for its assessment of the threat of weapons of mass destruction in pre-war Iraq, an independent report found this week. This is such a coincidence. All three major allies had How does that happen? There has been a failure of intelligence on Iraq. WMD intelligence was thin, ambiguous, and incomplete, former intelligence chief Philip Flood said in a report, which mirrors similar intelligence inquiries in the United States and Britain. The prime minister claims he was cleared. Yeah, systemic. And here is the Australian intelligence whistleblower Andrew Wilkie being interviewed by Australia's ABC radio this week in the wake of that report.
Mass destruction and terrorism weren't the main issues in Washington.
John Howard said last night that he doesn't remember being told that intelligence was thin or incomplete. Would that be the case?
Look, I don't accept that that statement from John Howard. The ONA assessments were always measured, and they were always heavily qualified. You know, it's not good enough for the government to be still saying that they accurately reflected the intelligence advice they were receiving, because there's now two reports in a row have made the observation that the government went well beyond the intelligence advice it received.
Well, if you could hear that,
that was deep and
highly reassuring. And if you didn't, we're not hearing this now. Why is that? You are. Oh, I'm not hearing the radio broadcast. I'll set up. What we're learning, by the way, the White House helped block a Republican brokered deal on Wednesday to extend several popular middle-class tax cuts. Does that mean the president is against tax cuts? And President Bush campaigned this week. He wants to be the peace president. Anytime, babe. That concludes this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network. Really? Up and down the east coast of North America from the east from the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Whenever you want it, archived and live. And now available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow. And it'd be just like the Hood Dairy Blimp protecting us all if you'd agree to be with me then. All righty? Thank you very much. My thanks to Steve Herbert for making this come together. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. LeShow Internet Services by Steve Mack. LeShow playlists available at kcrw.com. And I'll be joining Warren Olney on PRI's To the Point all this week on many of these same stations. So get off my back, Warren. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.